Welcome to another edition of Roughing the Passer podcast. I'm Pete Prisco, joined by Brady Quinn, the quarterback apologist himself, and Pat Kerwin, the GM. We're going to start calling you the GM, Pat.
You always talk of me as the Seahawk apologist. I'm okay with that.
Well, yeah. I mean,
and I have to actually provide some sort of, I guess, common sense to what's happening with quarterbacks. So, because you're always harping on them and bashing on them, Pete, but at some point, you've got to realize there's another side to the story. It's not just, you know, your perspective.
Well, there's other sides of the story than my perspective?
Yes.
You're forgetting the...
We're not all living in your world, Pete.
Well, that's your problem. You forgot the number one adage of life. What's good for me is good for me. You know, I saw a guy with a shirt the other day, by the way. I was in the elevator. I looked over and I go, like your shirt. It said, sorry, you can't all be me. You like you some Brady Quinn. I don't know what you're talking about.
Pat, is there any way we can get Pete to push along the narrative of today's podcast?
Yeah, we're going to push it along to Brady Quinn and his quarterback days, and we're going to talk about your foot.
Okay.
And the reason I want to talk about your foot, news comes out after a horrendous performance by Peyton Manning. Four picks, didn't look the same, and now we get word that he's got plantar fasciitis in his foot. You had feet problems back when you played. Tell us about that and just how it impacts you as a quarterback.
Okay, so if I'm not mistaken, I think what was reported is he has a tear in his plantar fasciitis in his left foot, which means the bottom of his foot. Those are the muscles that extend underneath your feet, right? So I had a Lisfranc injury, which is a ligament up in the midfoot, and it also was actually in my left foot. So I didn't end up having surgery then, probably should have. But tried to go through a different route. But in coming back from that and dealing with that, one of the issues that I think a lot of quarterbacks have, is in particular right-handed quarterbacks, is that is the foot in which that you're planting on as you transition from your back foot to front foot in your throwing motion. So what becomes difficult is the pain that you have to endure when you're going through it, because not only, one, does it hurt every time you go to throw and you put that foot on the ground, right, which messes up the chain reaction throughout the course of your body as you throw, but also your body naturally, subconsciously, is going to alter the way in which you plant, right? What does that cause then? Inconsistency with your motion, with how you plant your feet, your hips, and so forth. And also, it's going to take away some of that power, right? Because, again, subconsciously, your body's not going to put itself through more pain, right? It's going to try to alter itself. So as you're transitioning off that back foot to then push forward and step with your left foot and then throw the football, you're not going to be able to use as much power from your right to left foot because of that pain. And to me, that's where I saw some of the inaccuracy and some of the lack of strength and zip on the ball with Peyton, and I've seen that. So I think it's more of a factor of some of the injuries he's dealing with, which I think there's a rib issue and shoulder issue.
To me, I think that's the one they're being quiet about, because I think, and you would know this better than me too, but anything you do, if your core is messed up, there's some kind of pain there, that would also show up.
Yeah, that would show up big time, just in his ability to be rotate through the throw and, again, use his core, right? Your hips, your shoulder, and your abdomens and all that, using your core to be able to get through the throw. If there's any, I guess, lack of energy transfer from your feet, right? That really, that's where the throw starts. Taking all that power, all that force production from the ground, and then raising it up through your arm and through your right index finger to release the football. That if there's any break in that, those biomechanics or that chain, it's going to take away the consistency and accuracy, but also the power.
And Pat, mm-hmm. I watched him yesterday, and people call me a Peyton Manning apologist, by the way. And in fairness, I've appreciated his career for a long time. I know him. I've got to know him. He's a great guy to talk to in the locker room. He's very open and honest about things. But I'll be honest with you. Yesterday, he looked done to me. And now we get reports of the injury. And a lot of people will say, Pat, that every time he plays poorly, we get another report of an injury. What was your thoughts when you were sitting there with the guys yesterday watching Peyton Manning do what he was doing?
Yeah, well, I'm going to comment for sure on that, but I'll say this just to finish off Brady's whole point about his left foot. The problem when you have the pain and you can't transfer your weight from your right to your left foot as you finish the throw, the throws are coming out high. You're going to let the ball go early because you don't want to transfer your weight to the front foot. And some of those interceptions and erratic throws, a lot of them were high ball. And so that makes sense to me. If you see the throws and then hear about what the injury is, you can almost justify and accept that it's true. At a 39-year-old guy with a breaking down body, he can't afford any biomechanical breakdowns because he doesn't have the leg strength anymore, and you really do throw at your legs. So when I watched him, I feel bad for him because he got, you know, he's trying to break records. He's trying to win games. He's very competitive. He doesn't even practice on Wednesdays anymore. They're trying to preserve him. They knew all along that if they let him throw 40 times a game and let him take hits in games, that he was going to break down. Now, he's breaking down earlier this year than he did last year. Do they have the guts to do the right thing here? And does he have the willingness to basically sit down for 2 to 3 weeks and recover? Because look how he did the week after his bye. And then all of a sudden, he's right back to this. There's no, and this is true of all guys at his age in professional sports, there's no, and Brady should talk about it, there is no recovery time. He can't recover like he did before. He can go and get all the ice bags and all the whirlpools he wants. His body isn't recovering in time to play every week.
No, and I like to call this the hangover effect, because that's something I'm going to compare this to. You know, when you're young, you can go out and drink and party all night, and you can get up the next day and carry on with your life. It doesn't affect you quite as much. It's the same thing with as you're an athlete when you get older. I mean, it literally, at 27 years old, which doesn't sound very old, I started to notice myself not recovering quite as well after two-a-days or after workouts, and it increasingly had gotten worse as I got older. Now, I'm only 31 years old now, but so I can only imagine what it's like for Peyton Manning at this point in time. And, Pat, you talked about, you know, not being able to find time to rest. I mean, he's already taking off Wednesdays. He's already taking off and having less of a load on Thursdays and Fridays. I mean, besides just sitting out altogether and then waiting till game day, I'm not really sure what else you can do.
No, well, it's called retirement, and it's a bad
word. Wow!
Well, it's coming to that. Father Time is undefeated.
Right.
And he's so good and so mentally capable. He's still capable of a good game every 2-3 weeks, as long as he's properly physically adjusted to that moment. And then he needs another time off. So it's unfortunate. He probably played 1 year too long, but he got his records yesterday. And I looked at his face, and I really wondered, did he even think it was worth it? A lifetime of work to climb the biggest mountain, passing yardage, get it, and stand there and just look beat down.
You know what I said? I said he looked like a guy who was getting ready to go to the proctologist.
Oh, my God.
That's what he looked like. And then the rest of the game, he played like he was at the proctologist. I mean, it was painful to watch.
Oh,
it was bad.
Man.
Look, the thing that's, is,
that
though,
is
he started
a lousy analogy.
What's that?
That is a cruel and hit him for me, Brady.
Yeah, but Brady hasn't been to the proctologist yet. He's not our age yet, Pat, so he can't relate to that one.
The only thing I can relate to with that is watching the Seinfeld episodes where it had the ass man on the license plate. That's the only thing I can. That's the only way I can relate to it.
Let me tell you, when you get to be 40, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, right, Pat? He knows what I'm talking about.
Here you go, Brady. Enjoy these 9 years.
Oh, man.
But in a public service announcement to all out there, make sure you go there and do that, by the way. I have to say that. I want, because a lot of men are scared. You know that, Pat. Just go. Because it's better to be alive than that. But back to Peyton, though. Here's the thing on Peyton. He's making mental mistakes now. That bothers me as much as anything. I don't know. You're a quarterback. When physical stuff starts going wrong, does your mind start becoming an issue as well? In other words, you think about this and take away from your decision making.
I think the pain will definitely deter you from that, right? The pain can distract you if there's no way of finding a way to numb it, whether that's with Toradol or whatever else. So the pain can distract you and keep you from that lack of focus that you need. I didn't see it the same type of way. When I look at that game in particular, you know, Emmanuel Sanders went out kind of early, ended up passing through a concussion protocol, but I think he had a banged up ankle as it was, so they sat him out for the rest of the game. So you had younger guys kind of mixing in there, whether it was Cody Latimer, Andre Caldwell, guys who Caldwell plays a little bit more than Latimer, but even then, you know, I kind of more put it on some of those wide receivers. You never truly know what some of those mistakes are out there. It can look like a bad reader, or it can look like he was doing something wrong.
But he threw the linebacker, dropped out in the middle of coverage.
Didn't see that guy. I can guarantee you that. So that to me is not a mental mistake. I think he was just going across his progression, trying to anticipate, mm-hmm, which he has to do now, and there's no way he saw him.
You've been mentioned of Toradol. And that's become a bit of an issue in the National Football League. The line, I remember guys would walk around with Band-Aids when I covered the Jaguars, they had Band-Aids, and you know who was getting the Toradol. Is that something that's worth getting for a player, and did you get it, and would you do it all over again if you could?
Yeah, I did get it before a couple games, and I would probably do it over again in order to play if I felt like that was what I needed at that point in time to try to compete and try to, you know, get to the point in my career where I want to. But there's definitely some side effects. There's definitely, who knows what the long-term ramifications are. It used to be cortisone. That's essentially what we're talking about here, is it's a different type of essentially cortisone, if you want me to put it that way. And actually, the NFL is really locked down on this. They make you sign waivers. They talk to you before. It's not like a free-for-all like it used to be, where you'd see a line of guys waiting to go get these Toradol
before
injections.
And after the game.
Yeah, because they want to feel good. I mean, look, everyone wants to enjoy life, and you want to enjoy your job, what you're doing, and it is the greatest thing in the world to be able to play football as your profession. But with that comes a lot of pain, and you know, with that, then, you know, takes away from your actual overall life experience. So yeah, you'd want to be able to get through the game, play the way you're capable of, you know, go out there and push your body to the max, and then after the game, you don't want to, you know, be let down from that high. You want to continue to maintain the same ability to feel okay after the game and see your family and friends and loved ones.
Pat, I could have used Toradol the other day. I was working out at a track in Jacksonville, and they locked me in, and I had to go over the fence. I'm a 55-year-old man. I got to go over the high fence. It came down on the other side. I looked at myself. I said, I'm too damn old for this crap. Are you kidding me? I need a Toradol.
Being on the track, too. Try just using the sidewalks.
Yeah. Pat, when you were GM, what was the philosophy on painkillers and that kind of Toradol and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, a lot of guys took Toradol. And a lot of guys lined up for it. And Brady's description of the line coming out the trainer's room is accurate. I think a lot of that went away because the clubs became much more conservative about the use of it. But a lot of guys felt psychologically like they had to have it to get through the game. And if they were and from now, from November through the end of the season, everybody's got pain. And when you're sitting at your locker and you're in your mind going, I'm doing this natural. And the guy next to you gets a Toradol shot and he turns to you and says, man, I feel great. I'll be able to go. That's the first step towards walking into that room to get it. And then the next one is when the doctors would say, it's a real pain issue now. You really can't do much more damage. That was the second reason they'd go in there.
Pat,
I can tell you, and I'm not mentioning the players' names, but I know a player that, and you probably know plenty in this one, Brady, he'd get a Toradol cocktail the night before the game, basically intravenous. And he'd do it on Saturday nights before the game. Now, he had a shoulder, he had a hip, and he had an ankle. And he wasn't going to be able to play, and he wanted to play. Now, but what happens 10 years later, if you stay in the business long enough, then you start seeing the lawsuits. I didn't know what I was doing, so you're going to pay for the rest of my life. And that's why they've got all this layers of legalese to make sure you understand before you do anything. And it's not illegal. So we're not talking about somebody hiding behind something that's illegal. It was legal to take Toradol, and players still take a painkiller in order to play. So those are the facts of life. This is a pain-ridden game, as Brady said. So there was a hangover to it too, Brady. I just recall a number of guys, the ones that took it, specifically the ones I'd see on Mondays, they weren't feeling real good.
Pat, I'm going to date myself here, but you'll remember this. North Dallas 40, there was a scene where a wide receiver refused to take, you'll remember this, because it's based on the Dallas Cowboys, true, loosely based on the Cowboys. He refused to take a painkiller for, his name was Delmar Huddle, whatever. He ended up taking the painkiller and pulled up lame, he couldn't feel his leg, and they hit him in the face. So there was always a perception that players would be apprehensive to take painkillers. Brady, you wince when I said that. You flat out wince when I said that.
Yeah, because look, this is your livelihood. I mean, this is how you put food on the table for your family and your kids. It changes. I mean, if they had the opportunity to play and make this kind of money you can make in the NFL, it changes your families for generations. And then really it changes the outcome of the opportunities you can present, you know, future generations in their lives. So there's a risk to it without a doubt, but at the same time, you're putting yourself through it in order to realize that you're sacrificing for your family.
This is something that's always been on my mind. You're an NFL quarterback. You play a game on Sunday. What is it like Monday morning getting out of bed for Brady Quinn? Describe it to the audience. I want to hear what it actually feels like after you play a game, a full game, you take your shots, you know, you get hit a lot, you get up in the morning. What's it feel like getting out of bed? Describe it.
I'll compare it to this. Maybe this doesn't help as much, but I used to box a little bit too and cross train. And I'd spar, and I'd be smart about who I sparred with, but it would be like waking up from sparring for about 5 or 6 rounds. Where you're sore all over your core, your abs, your sides and all that. Your shoulders sore. A lot of times you have a hard time even sleeping through the night, so you're not even sleeping that well, so you're tired and groggy. Usually you've got, you know, maybe an ankle or a knee or something tweaked. You know, some of your joints feel a little bit loose just from a compromised position that you're in at some point in the game, whether you're being tackled or whether you went down to the ground. There's usually cuts and scrapes on your forearms or hands and things like that. And then, you know, you may be, you know, just battling through whatever sort of issue, but it's crazy. I mean, look, I'm 31 and I haven't been in camp since 2014. And to be honest with you, I miss that feeling. Like I really do.
Oh my God.
Maybe I'm sick and twisted, and Pat, you can tell me otherwise, but, I miss that feeling because it felt like you went through so much the day before, and it made that week, everything you worked toward in that week and really your entire life, it made it feel like it was worth it.
Absolutely. And I haven't met a player that doesn't miss it, and they knew all the circumstances they were involved in, and they remember all the pain. But, you know, and to your point about how it feels on game day, adrenaline is an interesting phenomenon in your body. When you're revved up to play, it almost masks every pain. And then on Monday morning, there is no adrenaline pumping. So everything that was naturally masked is out on the surface. And things that did not hurt the day before, like I saw a guy's knee get bent yesterday. He got up, he shook it around a little bit, and he played. And I just turned to Bill Cowher and said, we both know that guy won't be able to walk tomorrow. But right now, he's in the middle of this game. So, you know, all that's part of what happens. I will tell you, one head coach once came to me and said, I wish I could tell you his name because it's pretty funny. He said, yeah, we were talking about Toradol. And I said, how was it in your place? And he goes, yeah, it got to be like a damn epidemic. And he goes, one day the trainer comes to me about an hour and a half before the game. He goes, hey, we're out of Toradol. And there's 8 guys left. And this coach said to him, just give them water. They won't know the difference.
Did they? I bet they knew the difference.
Yeah.
No, he said, yeah, if they ever say they're the control group.
Well, I will say this too. It's not advised, but I would try to get to the hot tub as quick as possible because that was the only way, because sometimes that actually increases the inflammation for some of those bumps and bruises, etc. But it was the only way you didn't feel stiff and you didn't feel like your joints and everything felt kind of like locked up. Go ahead, Pat.
No, but your whole point that you're going to make here is the Chip Kelly research on how he trains. Forget his other stuff, but, you know, the days he works out, the days he doesn't work out, it's got a lot to do with that, the recovery rate stuff.
Yeah, and it's hard to recover. I know. I've had guys where I've talked to them and they said, I said, tell me about the week. And they said, okay, Monday you feel like crap. Tuesday you start feeling like crap. You still feel like crap. Wednesday you go out and practice. You start to feel a little bit better. And then you practice. You start feeling like crap again. You get to Friday and you go, okay, I'm feeling a little bit better. Saturday you feel okay. And then Sunday you feel like crap again.
Yes. The only comparison I can make as far as the Chip Kelly deal is the Miami Dolphins tried to do that in camp during 2014 when I was with them. And it was interesting because the day after the game where usually you're a little bruised up or banged up, you'd go in, you get a workout, you're sitting through film and all this stuff, and you feel like crap, but like the workout kind of helped you flush a little bit of that out. But at the same time, you come back in the next day, like that Tuesday, that's your off day. You'd still always go in as a quarterback. You would sit there and still feel like crap, and you still try to work out and try to get it out of your system because that was all you really knew. It is usually just a big film day. And in this Chip Kelly style, it's more for the central nervous system because you kind of hit this peak when you play in a game, and the crash is so hard after a game, right? You're so exhausted mentally and physically that you really want to be able to get the most amount of rest you can. That's why they have that day after the game off. So those guys can sleep in. They can sleep longer than they're used to, try to get more rest, try to let their body recover and work back into it gradually, and then start back into it Tuesday. You know, that used to be the off day, but then start to kind of ramp it back up again. And then your Wednesday is a really heavy day, back down again Thursday and Friday, and then you ramp back up again on Saturday. So it kind of it allows your body to kind of recover at like a more moderate pace, I'd say, and then even recover then again on that Thursday, Friday, as it's not quite as bad as it used to be.
Speaking of quarterbacks who probably feel like crap today, Aaron Rodgers is not playing very well right now. I mean, he just isn't, and the offense isn't clicking. What do you think the problems are, Pat, with the Green Bay Packers offense?
Well, multiple problems here. First off, the protection stuff up front. If you look at the last 3 weeks, and some of those were great teams, but guess what? We thought they were a great team. They're not able to protect him. I haven't put a stopwatch on him. It's going to be easy to do. Go back and look at it. But Brady, I'll bet you he's holding the ball at least a half a second longer than he used to. I know on one of the sack things I did last week, we talked about it when he played Carolina. He held the ball, and I put a watch on the blitz plays. He held the ball for 6.5 seconds, waiting for someone to get open, and then eventually got sacked. He just couldn't find anybody. And I think there are people that are realizing how to play him now. Your outside contained rushers better never cross the tackle's face. Just don't let, because he's very dangerous outside. And so there's a little method to how they're playing him, and I don't think this line in front of him is very good, and the receivers don't have the separation skills they need for him to be his best.
Yeah, and the other part of the other caveat to that is, you know, Jordy Nelson just seems to be, in my mind, as the guy that always used to be able to find a way of getting open once Rodgers would get outside the pocket, once he was able to extend the play or hold on to the football. And I think it's the lack of Nelson, the lack of having a wide receiver that not only can get open when the play breaks down, but also get open sooner. It just seems like, for whatever reason, Davante Adams and Randall Cobb, they're not on the same page, and they're not getting enough separation in order to allow Aaron Rodgers to trust them and get the ball out of his hands sooner, and that comes with anticipation, and I'm just not seeing it right now.
Is there something they can do scheme-wise? And I'm going to dive into the Packers this week because I can't wait. I'm going to break them down on film this week. But is there something they can do scheme-wise to help get guys who aren't winning open in the context of what they do offensively?
I'm going to use Bill Parcells for my answer, and then Brady can shoot a hole in it if he cares to. When I was around Parcells, I was with him for 1 year there, and I recognized how he saw quarterbacks and how he saw problems. I'm going to guess that his answer to your question, which I would support, is he liked using bunch principles whenever it was stuff like this. Three-man bunch routes, little explode routes, and then put the first and second read right in the quarterback's face so he doesn't have to open up to anything else. And throw the ball. Keep it really simple. And he did a lot of it. And he did a lot of it with Vinny Testaverde when he started three rookie linemen. And I realized that is a nice, simple package. You can't live with it all the time. But, boy, I would feature it more with a bunch of guys that aren't getting open.
Wait, I mean, case in point, to use that as an example, you go look at the Indianapolis Colts when Andrew Luck was playing versus the Broncos and they got that win in Indy. Rob Chudzinski, who recently was made the offensive coordinator there, that's exactly what he utilized. He utilized bunch formations, stack formations. It helped Andrew Luck get the ball out of his hand quicker. And it's not any knock on Andrew Luck. It's just the fact that it helped him actually speed up his process, getting those guys open quicker, getting them open in space, and it paid off huge dividends. And I think that's one strategy of how you'd go about doing it. Pete, you wrote about it. I mean, the pick plays and all that, it's well documented that these teams now go into Green Bay or whenever they play the Packers, they say, look out for this. I mean, they're warning the officials of it. It's starting to be harped on. You're starting to see it more and more called. And oftentimes you see this offensive pass interference because of these pick plays that Green Bay used to be so successful with. But now they got to adjust because they can't run them quite as often.
And Pat, you mentioned the offensive line play. And I haven't studied them on tape yet in depth, which I plan to do. But just watching their games and looking at some of their games on tape, Bakhtiari has regressed in a big way. I mean, that guy, you know, last year was a good, solid player. And they had the same five, one of the only teams in the league that had the same five play last year, and they had them all back. And as a unit, they're just not playing very well.
They're not. And they're just an average group. I think Brady said it a few weeks ago. If you look at their linemen, they look like throwbacks to the 60s, and they're blocking phenomenal athletes, and they look like physical mismatches. They're good if you have a power run. Like last year when Eddie Lacy got it rolling, we'll talk about him later, but that helped that line a lot. And they were playing out there with limited athletes, to say the least. But the last 2 weeks, Brady, I'm going to count them here. It's 107 pass plays in 2 weeks. That's what they've done. That line can't block 107 pass plays in 2 weeks.
Well, and I don't care what quarterback you are, what system you're in. If you're throwing the football that much, you're not coming away with wins. And that was actually.
What about Brady? His line isn't very good, and they throw it a ton, too. How does he compensate for it?
Well, I think the way they go about doing it, too. I mean, think about it. When's the last time you saw them eating up huge chunks with shots downfield? Now, that's kind of come in the past couple weeks, hitting Brandon LaFell. He's kind of emerged. And he's going to have to step up if Julian Edelman's going to be out. But they've been a team that's methodically worked the ball down the field, taking the high percentage completions, and moving forward. And I think they've also done that because they didn't want to play into the hands of the New York Jets with that defensive line, that defensive front. Probably the same thing with the Buffalo Bills, who they'll have to play this week. So I think that's why you see them implement that strategy, not because they can't run the football, but because it gives them the best chance to win. With Rodgers and these guys, I mean, look, it was actually a record for the most attempts he's had in his career last week. I forget what the number was, 53?
61?
61, yeah. So by far and away a record for the amount of attempts in a game. And I just think they're putting too much on his shoulders at this point in time. I wouldn't be surprised either if something's not bothering him physically, if he doesn't have some sort of ailment that maybe is or is not on the injury report that's bothering him, and that maybe affected some of those throws too, being a little bit off.
Should they go back, you know, and I got to go back and look, but they always seem to play fast at the line of scrimmage, and then sometimes they back away from it, and sometimes they go back to it. Should they go back to playing fast all the time, Pat?
I don't want to indict anyone, but I'd go back to Mike McCarthy.
Me too.
Calling the plays. And this is not that Tom Clemens can't do it. It's not that there's a great relationship between Clemens and Rodgers or whatever. It's just, I think, a little sense of urgency here. Just like Chudzinski had an instant effect on how that play calling went, I think intervention by Mike, and I don't particularly like doing it this way, but he's a proven play caller, just like Jason Garrett is. I thought Jason Garrett's best skill was play calling. Those two guys, to me, should be calling the plays for their teams.
You know what's interesting, though, and from an inside source and some things that I hear, is that Aaron Rodgers changes those plays a lot more often than people realize. And I always wonder then, like, what effect really does the play caller, whether it's Tom Clements or Mike McCarthy, have? And I would say this, I guess, to that question. If it's your head coach who you're out there audibling and making changes, you're probably going to have a lot tougher time than coming off the sideline and justifying yourself, as opposed to it being Tom Clemens in this case, who Aaron has a great relationship with in the quarterback room. So I'm curious to see, if Mike McCarthy does take over the play calling, if we see Aaron Rodgers change as many calls as he does at the line of scrimmage at this point.
So, in other words, you're saying, and I agree with you, it'd be easier to audible out of a Tom Clements called play than it would be to audible out of a Mike McCarthy called play.
I think so.
Out of respect for the head coach.
Yeah, out of respect for the head coach, and maybe just the fact that when you come over on the sidelines, I mean, this is the head man that you've got to answer to. So if you made a bad check or something didn't work out, I mean, you've got to instantly hold yourself accountable to a guy who's, you know, the head coach, who's calling the plays, and immediately, you know, he's trying to take this thing over and take an effect.
What's it like when you're a quarterback and you check out of a play and it's into a bad play and you come to the sideline? You got any experiences with those where you got berated by the guy?
Of course. And my always rebuttal back to you is, you know, hey, when I run a bad play call that you call, I don't come back and chew you out for it. You know, because there's times when I've been with coordinators who have said, you know, hey, lock it. Like, meaning, no matter what they show us, just run the play. And I've been in that scenario before. We were in Kansas City. It was a 4th-and-1. I looked at the look, and I said, I either need to flip this call and run the ball the other way, or I need to make a re-identification. Really, checking to a pass would have been a much better opportunity. They wanted us to stick with the call. I went ahead and did it. We didn't get it. And I kind of walked off like, there you go. If that's how you want to handle things and you don't want to give me the opportunity and the freedom to be able to change something and help our team win, then I'll do what you're saying, but then you've got to take the consequences in front of the media.
So you come to the sideline, and what happens then? Did you say something to him? Hey, why didn't you give me the chance to check out?
No, look, at that point in time, you don't want to distract away from what you're trying to get accomplished. But there's no doubt in my mind after the game or the next day we were sitting in the quarterback room going over film.
Worst play you ever checked to that you shouldn't have checked to, and what was the result and what happened?
Gosh, I wasn't the type of quarterback to check two plays unless this one, Kansas City 2012. There's a look called a 3-1-3, all right? And basically what happens is defenses will use this particular blitz on third down, and they'll put two linebackers on the outside of your tackles on each side. We were in a 3-by-1 formation, and it was 3rd and 9. So clearly passing down, clearly, and that's why they're showing pressure to blitz, right? So they've got two guys on each side outside on the line of scrimmage. They've got then three defensive linemen, a nose, and then 2-5 techniques, so two guys over the tackles, right? And they call it 3-1-3 because right. You got three on each side, right. One nose. Well, where they lack, right, if you do the math on that, that's seven guys. So they've got essentially two corners on the outside, a deep middle field safety, and a guy over the slot. So when you're looking at it, you're going, holy cow, there's no one, there's no linebacker over the guards. There's no one in the middle of the field.
Right.
So the check we wanted to get to was this single, it's basically a one-back power run. We pull the right guard, and they're actually going to pin that left side. And basically it's just a quick handoff, and you absolutely gash it.
Exactly.
So what happened was as we get the play call and as they're lining up, essentially they were in that look, but then one of the linebackers started to kind of move back as the cadence happened as we're snapping the ball. So it, in retrospect, it looks bad because the result of the play, we only got 3 yards on it. A guy ended up getting chased down the backside. The problem is, had we just blocked the backside, had our right tackle actually blocked the guy off the backside edge like he was supposed to,
25-yard gain,
it would have been easily a first down. So I come off the sidelines, and they're ripping me because we're still in the game. We still have an opportunity instead of sticking with the pass where I would have had to throw a sight adjust, right? And we still wouldn't have gotten it anyways. He was ripping me for changing
you?
It. I'm not going to throw
come
it.
Come on, throw him under the bus.
You can do work on that and figure it out. But I'm getting ripped for it. I'm looking back at the film room saying, this is the look that we talked about all week. This is the look that we want to check this particular play. So you can't get on me now that I'm utilizing it when we would have had to throw a sight adjust on the backside because of the pressure anyways. And you would have gotten tackled for a loss because it probably would have been a slant.
Pat, how about you? Over the course of you've been with a lot of teams, do you remember any instance like that stands out where the guy checked into some bad play and it ended up being horrible and he got berated for it and it ended up costing you games?
It happens every week. And it depends on the credibility of the quarterback before you go down the road. Now, you get a rookie quarterback or your backup's in, tends to be ripped a little bit more than yelling at Boomer Esiason. I'm with Boomer, and Boomer's making a check at the line of scrimmage because he sees something. He threw one. We were playing the Dolphins, and he made a check to what I'd call a skinny post on the weak side. It was a 3-by-1 set. It was interesting. You were talking about that. And it looked like it was singled over there, Brady, but it wasn't. And they really had on a post-snap roll into it, which we told him, and he threw it through an interception. We lost the game. He felt worse than us. So I said, look, you got to take the good with the bad and the bad with the good here. This guy, we weren't even going to be in the game if that guy wasn't making those kind of adjustments. So why we harp on one thing? And our quarterback coach, Walt Harris, at the time, and a good friend of mine, we were on the bus talking about it. And I said, how are we going to handle that? He goes, I'm going to put it up in the film room on Monday. We're going to just ramble through. And when we get to the play, I'm going to stop and have a conversation and see how far he wants to take himself in the blame game. And then we'll work it out from there. I think the more experienced coaches that are not impulsive will handle things that way. But one of the things when I was a college coach, when I was an offensive coordinator for about 9 years, a lot of times I didn't want to get into putting the quarterback in too many situations. So we had a lot. Whenever I felt like we were in a struggle area, and it's college, not pro football, but we would do a lot more stuff on the first down, Brady, just to keep the quarterback away from the audible system without telling them it. Hey, this is on the down sound, this is on the up sound. And back to the bunch stuff. When you're in a little bunch game, you pretty much can do that on the first down, and the quarterback is taking some stress off him. They put you under a lot of pressure to spend a week of practice telling you, and you're a smart guy, when you see this, this is what we'd like you to do. You see it, you go to it, now they want to blame you. It takes a lot of self-control on your part not to go, you know, defend yourself. And then what happens is the credibility of the next week's installation is already in jeopardy because you don't trust them.
By the way, the guy that Brady yelled at was Brian Daboll.
You know, don't even say anything, Brady. Say nothing.
His face says it all. And if I was a quarterback, I'd think all my I'd check a lot because I think they were always right.
It's not that easy though, because you can't all of a sudden be you know, a wild man or some sort of nomad where you're going off the reservation and you're not sticking with the things that you practice all week long. Because also the thing is, when you're doing your own thing out there, you've got to have the rapport and the connection with the guys that you're working with to be on the same page. And if you haven't practiced it, that's a scary place to be in. So that's not always the best way to do it, just to audible all the time and check out a
place. No, I'm kidding. Would you have liked to have been a guy, could you have called your own plays? You know, the old quarterbacks used to call their own plays and stuff. Could you have done that?
Yeah. I mean, you go back to college when Charlie Weiss got there. And look, he gave me a New England playbook. That was the first thing I had. And I just literally dove into that. And I was like, this is the coolest thing ever, because essentially I can always help our team be in the best play possible. Whereas I was running a West Coast system before, and I started as a true freshman in sophomore year. They gave me a little bit more on my plate, but not to the point where what Charlie did. You know, he really kind of liberated me in the sense of, we ran a no-huddle system basically the second half of my senior year. And I would just go out there and he'd call a play, but if I saw something else, check to this. You see this, audible to this. You see that, whatever you want.
What about the NFL? Could you have called plays?
It's still different. It's the same similar style system.
But it's a lot more complicated defense.
The defense has become a bit more complicated, but at the same time, what you see sometimes is you get a lot more one-on-one coverage. You working to playmakers and things like that. Like, even though the offense becomes more complicated, the defense becomes more complicated, what becomes easier in the NFL systems is go to your number one guy. Go to your playmaker. Go to your difference maker. Because when you work towards that guy, he's the one that can change everything. As if you have a true number one, a guy that you can rely on in the passing game, or a running back who you can get the ball to, those are the guys that can help make differences in games and really help win for you.
Pat, before, back in the day when you were leather helmets and the messenger guards and stuff, remember all the quarterbacks used to call their own plays. Do you think it's still possible for guys to be play callers and take the coaches out of it?
I would like to see more quarterbacks in control of the offense. And as they earn their stripes, and that doesn't mean getting older, it just means getting smarter. And when you're smart enough, I think quarterbacks, we did them all a disservice. This all started with Tom Landry. I just think that the quarterbacks have a great feel for the game. And if you build your offense the right way, you can put them in the best situations. We just call them classic conflicts. Like, this play is married to this play. So if they're going to defend play one, just play two is better. And if you build it that way, the quarterback can go out and play better. The coach is literally a play late every time. He is calling something based on what he's seen in his scouting report early in the game or in the middle of the game on what they've been doing. The quarterback is not a play late. That's why I believe the quarterback should be doing it, which is probably music to Brady's ears. And I'm not, you know, the coach can help quite a bit, but I think there's too many guys obsessed with winning games with their favorite plays and being known for something. I think it's better off if you train your quarterback to play with an open mind on the field.
You know, I can't stand either, Pat, is when sometimes there's, you know, a head coach wants to, you know, during the course of the week, you see what's going on in practice. You see what your team's running. You see it, you know, after meetings at night when you're sitting there with the coaches talking about your game plan for the next day and how you're going to go about preparing for certain scenarios, certain situations. And then all of a sudden you get in the course of a game and he's yapping in the OC's ear, or he's talking to you about what plays he wants to run or what he sees out there. It's like, look, if you want to take over play calling, then take it over on a full-time basis. But otherwise, let the guys you've hired do their job. I mean, because you know, the thing, especially when you have a defensive head coach, because then all of a sudden you get really conservative. And that's the worst thing from an offensive guy and even a quarterback is when you start playing safe, when you don't start dictating to the defense tempo, pace, things like that, really, you know, put them back on their heels with the balance of what you're presenting instead of just run, run, pass,
right.
run, pass. And you see that all the time with defensive head coaches.
Hey, Pat, do you remember the messenger guards?
No.
When they used to send the plays in?
The guys who sell the plays in, yeah.
Think about that now. One of the biggest, most important things for an offense is cohesion on an offensive line. In every other play, you had a guard going out and a new guard coming in with the play call. That's how they got the – that was – if I'm not mistaken,
well, we always had wide receivers.
Paul Brown started that, didn't he, Pat, with the messenger?
Yeah, we were wide receivers, but I was coaching at Hofstra, a small school in the East here.
My dad went to Hofstra.
Yeah, a lot of – and a number of good NFL players from there, but – the beauty, one year, I don't know, it was 1982 or something like that, but we landed up having a deaf running back. It came to us from Indiana, and we all had to learn sign language, so I had to coach him. He was a running back. Once everyone learned the sign language, we stopped having to shuttle guys in. We could sign language the plays from the sideline. It was the greatest. And well, it was then, like...
therein lies that, signals, right?
Yeah, and that... yeah. Well, signals,
and the quarterback had to learn to do his signals behind his back because the running back was behind him, and he couldn't read his lips.
So even when you were at Notre Dame,
Brady, putting your hand behind your back and signaling the play change.
So even at Notre Dame, you had plays coming in with the wide receivers rather than signals back then.
No. They signal.
Oh, they signal.
Yeah, we signal, and then we had a wristband, so we'd have 300 plays on a wristband. And then they would signal in whatever the wristband was,
like,
and sit there and read
23?
Yeah, exactly.
Number, and you looked out at the number?
Yeah, so if we had like 240 plays or 200 plays, right, because we'd have this, it'd be a double-sided, then you'd open it up, there'd be like another side to it. So you'd have about maybe 150, 200 plays in all, but you could flip those. So he would signal in the number, then he'd say flip if you wanted the entire thing flipped. And that's where like I still remember we were playing Michigan State my junior year. And he sent in a play, and he wanted it flipped. But there's sometimes like you got to flip four things in it, right? You got to make sure you flip all the rights to lefts because everything's always in a right formation for a right-handed quarterback, you know, all that. And then you've got to make sure all the even numbers are then odd, right? To then flip it. So at some point, I think he said flip it. So I either missed the flip signal or I just called it wrong, and I actually ended up throwing. It was a pick six. It hit right off our tight end. He was running a shallow route across the line of scrimmage. John Carlson hit right off his hands, kind of like a volleyball set back up to the defense. They catch it. They run back in for the touchdown. And I get off the sidelines, and he's yelling at me about like the result of the play. And I'm like, it was a good ball. He's got to catch it. He's like, well, you didn't flip it in the first place, and that's why that happened. And I'm going, come on, man. Like that's not
the guy was open. He hit the right guy. He grabbed the ball, and he blamed you for not
flipping. Yeah, he's blaming me because he should have been running the other way, I guess. I mean,
all right, we're talking about play. So
let me just finish the card thing for a second, the wristband, because I was involved with one coach that he had wristbands. So you call 23. Brady looks at 23. But all the other 10 players wore a wristband, and they looked at 23, and it gave them their assignment, what they did. And even the lineman had a wristband with their line. So he goes, I'm not letting anyone out there without knowing what the heck to do. So there would be a time, and it was funny. I'm at his game, and he's sending a number in. And 11 guys are holding out their wrists like they're looking at their watch to see what time it is. I go, this is out of control.
That's great.
The funny thing about, you know, some play callers, you know, want to still utilize wristbands because if you think about it, it's actually faster.
Right.
Because if you called in the headset and you said 23, I look at 23 and I read it, that's only saying it once.
Right.
If you're looking at the sidelines, the play caller is calling it and reading it off in your helmet, and then you're repeating it, it's going to take a lot longer to say some of these long play calls twice.
Which is why I don't understand why more teams don't use the wristband. I look at my thing, I say I want 24.
Yeah.
You look at your thing, you got 24. You call it the play, boom, you go, and everybody knows. Why? It makes sense to me to use the wristband.
Sometimes they can add in variations of things like that to a play call, which they still could even with a number. You know, we talked about flipping it before, but also you can add, hey, tell the back to stand on this one, or tell the back to run a slice route instead of a swing route. I mean, things like that you can still change.
Brady, you know what drives me nuts? I'd like to hear your opinion. I think, and I got to know Coach Bill Walsh pretty well. We had to do a video series. I spent weeks with him. the language and the amount of wordage in a West Coast offense is completely unnecessary, in my opinion. They want to call everything, every route, everything. It's ridiculous. I don't know how a young quarterback coming from these no playbook offenses could even operate ever in a West Coast.
Call me a West Coast play. I want to hear it. Give me one.
I'm trying to find the easiest way to call to try to show you the differences between calls. To be simple, like in a West Coast, you could be like green right hound two. What could we call? I'm trying to think. I haven't been in West Coast.
Well,
in a while.
Is it like Gruden's favorite play, a West Coast staple?
Well, any Z shallow cross, right? You can make double right, scat right, Z shallow cross, X comeback, and you end up tagging essentially everyone out on it, an H swing, right? The problem is, one, it gets really wordy. But what you want to do is you want to create a word picture in your head. So while you're saying the play and you're telling each guy what he has, you're kind of in your head seeing it actually come alive, and then you can kind of get a feel for where you should go with each progression or each coverage. I always think the interesting thing is, so it's that, or it's you put pressure on your players, whereas Cadillac is just one place, right? So if we were in the New England system, you'd say something like zero, right? 134 Cadillac, all right? So then all five guys who are out in the routes, they have to remember what that is. Zero's the formation. It's green right if you're in West Coast. Ride 134 is like me saying hound two if I'm in West Coast. Same thing. It's just a play action pass set. And then you understand that if it was Cadillac in this particular case or Exxon, I can't remember which because I've been in two systems and variations where they changed it. But one's a post. You got an in on the backside. The tight end's got a shallow coming across. And then the fullback checks his protection and releases out in the flat and the halfback's over the ball. So that particular route concept, everyone's going to memorize once they hear Cadillac or Exxon what it is. So it's always interesting to me that there's two ways of doing it. You either put pressure on the guys to know it, if it's like a five-man route combination, or sometimes like a three-man route combination, they'll name something. Like bundle, for example, that'll be like a three-man route combination. Or they'll just tag you every single guy. And I don't care how you go about doing it. I don't care if I have to say the play extra long because it helps me with that versus, if it's just one word. It wasn't like mentally fatiguing for me as a quarterback. Sometimes it ensures that your wide receivers then know what they're doing, right? Because, they're actually hearing the route called out in the cadence. So you're like, if they mess that up, they're probably not smart enough to be on the field.
So the play call would come in from the sideline, the long verbiage play call, and then you'd have to repeat it.
Yep.
It's a lot of words.
Yeah.
It can be, and that's what rookies struggle with, is the being able to hear it.
How do you handle, Brady, with the West Coast long language one, how do you handle changing a play at the line of scrimmage?
So typically, there's a couple different schools of thought how you go about doing it. Usually in the midst of your cadence, so you don't get anyone to jump, a lot of teams like having like an easy, some sort of cadence to get everyone to kind of say, listen up, relax, but listen up. Because you don't want any of your linemen jumping off sides. And then you'd go into whatever your lot. There's a couple ways of doing it. You can go over into whatever your check is, right? You have code words for certain runs, and a code word to then explain which direction, even, odd, things like that. For example, colors, you sometimes utilize those. Sometimes you utilize it actually in your cadence, right? So you have like a particular color that you're using. Your typical cadence right here is set, white 80 hut. Well, sometimes you sit there and say set. Red 22, hut. And now you've essentially changed. Let's say red 22 is like a 22 called run play, right? It's like a 22 lead or something like that on the front side. You've essentially used that color red to be that hot color that it tells everyone to listen up. You might have to throw in a little signal to your wide receivers, but you also can use your cadence in that way to help then audible the play without necessarily defense catching on.
One of the things that Aaron Rodgers told me this summer was, and a lot of teams are getting concerned about it, is that on the tapes that the teams exchange now, the voices are on it.
Yep.
The sound is so good that sometimes it causes problems in terms of going back and redoing your signals. And that wasn't always the case because the sound equipment wasn't as good. In fact, he hates it. He thinks it's a pain in the butt, but it's gotten so good that the boom mics are right there that the teams now use that against. So you got to change up your signals when you play a division opponent, particularly, right?
People say that, but it's so hard to then, if you're a defense, for example, right? they've got the coach, the quarterback, too. So your middle linebacker is getting a call, and he's signaling out to everyone else if you're playing like a fast-paced offense, because that's what we're talking about. If right. these quarterbacks are signaling, it's because then they're in a no-huddle scenario. So then they've got to get their call, then they got to get lined up, and then they have to actually look over to find the signal. So it's hard for a defensive player on the field to do that. And even if a defensive coordinator gets it, he's got to then ensure the fact that he's able to communicate down to his player fast enough. He's able to communicate to their players to then be able to stop it. Like, I'm sitting there watching New England versus the Giants last night, and they ran. I wasn't exactly sure what the first signal was because the one wide receiver broke off the route. It used to be called, I think, sword or saber, but it was a shorter route, so they must have changed that one. But 10 was still 10, two ends. You know, that's the signal. That's how they run it. And it was just...
he comes to the line, he says 10?
No, he doesn't 10. He signals it.
How does he signal?
I'm not going to sell these guys out.
Yeah, we're going to sell them out. 10.
But it's a two-in combination. They use it on the backside of some of their two-minute routes, and they essentially ran that same exact one. They've been running that forever. That was since I was in college. This is the first New England playbook I got back when, you know, Josh McDaniels ended up taking over for Charlie Weiss. So it was curious just to see that they still use the same signals because it's the same guy running it. It's so hard for a quarterback to then all of a sudden change in the heat of the battle the signals and the verbiage that he wants to use because he's done it for so long. Why would you want to have to force him to think about it in the midst of the actual game?
Isn't there a little bit of an irony in there in the fact that here's a team that's been caught videotaping signals and they use the same ones that they always do?
I think it just goes to show it doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't. And we all know the signal guy on the sideline to the defense, and yeah, he's talking to the mic backer and the helmet and all that, but there's a secondary coach basically funneling in the coverage calls. I could tell Brady knows the calls for cover two. He knows that there's about four of them that you could use, and you can figure them out. Can you really spend the time staring at their guy? No, it's guys are yelling stunt calls up front. Brady's heard pirate 1,000 times. He's heard spike 1,000,000 times. Rant. All know what they are.
Pat, the best one is over the course of a game, in particular if you are running no huddle where you're a quarterback, you're at the line of scrimmage. Every defense has an R or an L word they use when their safeties are going to rotate down to one side or another.
Right.
It doesn't matter what team you're on. You hear it in training
rusty,
camp.
Rusty.
Yeah, whatever. Robert, Larry. Like, right. You always hear it and you're like, all right, this guy's eventually going to come down. I can tell because of the leverage on the slot anyways, but it's like, just go ahead and do it already. And like, it's just so funny to me that every single defense does it because those guys aren't as smart as the offensive players are.
Speaking of play calling, taking a shot at the defensive players. Speaking of play calling, and I sent you a tweet last night. You didn't respond to it. Do you remember? Did you see it?
Oh, actually, I did respond to your tweet, but you didn't respond to that. Well, here's what the context is of this, Pat. Do you remember our conversation last week? We were talking about how do you go in and beat Seattle, and Pete said, "Well, you got to throw the football.
Dictate tempo.
Dictate tempo. Okay. So he's all on his high horse because in the first two quarters of this past game with the Cardinals versus the Seahawks, that the Cardinals were looking good. Seahawks are playing bad, and they're up. Well, guess what? They went to the well one too many times because the only reason the Seattle Seahawks were in that game is because the Arizona Cardinals continued to pass and they continued to allow that pass rush to then get turnovers and get points and bring Seattle right back into that game.
And then what happened? Because they had the capability
They ran the football.
They didn't run the ball.
Look at their go-ahead touchdown. Pat, am I wrong?
They didn't
run the
ball.
Was that not a draw?
He went right down the field.
They rushed for 130 yards.
It was a draw play and a good call off the passing game.
They rushed for 130 yards in this game.
Are you going to sit here and tell me that they won the game because they lined up and ran the football at the Seattle Seahawks?
It helped them win the game in the end.
No, but why did they win the football game?
You brought up a great example. Did you think for a second he was going to go, you're right, Brady?
Yeah, it's a good point. He wants to hear that he's
right. I'm not right about everything, but I was right about that one. Key to winning that game was to dictate tempo to them and throw to score, get the lead. And yes, they made some mistakes by continuing to throw, but that's who Bruce Arians is. And then they continued to throw the football, and they caught him on a draw play because they were still capable of throwing the football.
No, they ran the ball well towards the end of
the
game.
They got to take away the draw play, which is a draw play off of the passing game. That's how it got keyed up.
You just can't give anyone else credit.
No, I'm not. Who's giving credit? I give credit to the play caller. Bruce Arians is a great play caller.
Yeah, well, look, again, agree to disagree. But
you don't think he's a great play caller?
I think he's a good play caller. But I'm saying I didn't see that was why necessarily that the Cardinals won. But I will say this. Here's what I think the Seattle Seahawks have struggled with is so far, every team that's kind of come in there and won, whether that's the Carolina Panthers or the Cardinals, you talked about dictating tempo. The Seattle Seahawks haven't been able to dictate their fingerprint or blueprint of what they want to do to succeed on any of their opponents when you're talking about the Panthers and the Cardinals. Both those teams have walked in there, and they've basically done what they wanted to do, and they've come away with wins, Pat.
I agree, and the other guys are Seattle shooting themselves in the foot. It seemed like every series start in the first half, there was up penalty, first and 15, up first and 20, and they're not built to come out of that hole. They cannot come out on first and 20s and succeed many times because it's automatic pass for them, and then they don't have the protection. So they have no margin for error. It's not like it's Carson Palmer throwing bombs. They're trying to play a different kind of game, so they can't be set back with penalties, and they seem to be set back a lot. Pete, did he say it's 16 penalties yesterday?
Yeah, I think it was 16. It was bad, and a lot. And you know what? It's hard to fault the officials in that because a lot of those were actually really good calls. I mean, there were holding and muggings and everything else. They got called in that game.
Can I ask you guys this? I have never been more sure. I'm 31 years now. I've never been more, I guess, unsure of what is a catch now in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm pretty sure no one knows, to include the officials. I sat with one every week. And those guys, they argue all the time. Mike Pereira is one of the best we've ever had, and he has been in disagreement with a lot of things. Bill Cowher, to me, said it best. You know, use the sideline and the end zone as two planes. If you come down with your feet on the football field and break those planes, it is either a touchdown, if you broke that plane, or it's a completion out of bounds. This whole world of – and it's always – and last year they made it worse. It was a football act, which they changed to becoming a runner. Since when does a guy – how do you define becoming a runner? I just had a guy, a carpenter here, working on my house. He's furious about that, and he says, I can't watch football anymore because I don't know what a catch is. They better fix it at the next competition committee meeting, and I think they will. There's an awful lot of pressure from a lot of important people to clean up the definition of a catch and get it simple. The officials can't even manage these games.
Yeah, and to that point of what makes or when are you considered a runner or what's considered a catch – a pivotal moment where the Arizona Cardinals continued to keep throwing the football and giving Seattle opportunities. They hit Daniel Fells at tight end. He literally catches the football, turns, takes three steps,
and
the ball is knocked out, recovered by Earl Thomas. It would have put the Seattle Seahawks in good field position, probably to end up going down to win the game, and they call that incomplete?
Yeah, that was weird.
I was baffled.
That was the worst one to me yesterday was Odell Beckham. Odell Beckham catches the ball, gets 2 feet down in the end zone, then the ball is popped out, and they said he didn't make the move. The whole idea is if you're in the end zone, you catch the ball, you get 2 feet down, that's a touchdown. That's the one that bothered me.
That's right. And what they were asking for is for him to make a runner's move. There is no runner's move in the end zone.
No.
Catch the ball 2 feet down, touchdown.
Right. Daniel Fells, I think they got wrong, but I also think that the Beckham thing is wrong for a different reason, because in the end zone, if I throw you a pass in the corner of the end zone, you get 2 feet down and pop out of the end zone and fall out of without falling to the ground because you got to control it to the ground. That's a touchdown. But essentially, that's what he did.
Well, tell me this, guys. What's taking these official reviews so long? There was a touchdown pass to Michael Floyd in the corner of the end zone. It was clear as day. He caught the football, got 2 feet down, and then went out of bounds. And it was like
with the ball going through the pylon for a touchdown.
No. This is the one where he caught it in the back.
Oh yeah. Oh, that one. Yeah.
It took him 5 minutes to review, and I'm going, what are we waiting on? How hard could this be?
Better, Brady. That should come down from upstairs. That guy doesn't even need to walk to the hood, the confessional. The guy should just call down and say touchdown.
Well, and again, I was talking with our EK, our boss, and he was talking about how pace of play has got to be a concern to the NFL, because if the average fan who's not a diehard NFL fan, like, for example, Europe, where they play soccer and they play fast and there's no stoppage, there was a ton of – that game last night was forever with a ton of stops. Is that a concern?
I think
it should be. The three-hour game is like the dinosaur. We're at like 315 or 316 now. Average of over all the games, but we've had plenty of 330 games.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you what, Pat, they're going to see it at an effect of the viewer base at some point, because you know, baseball, say what you want about it, it's a slow sport as it is, but they've even wanted to start to enact a rule where the pitchers couldn't take forever on the mound. They're essentially supposed to, once they get on the rubber, throw a pitch within 15 seconds or something like that. Otherwise, they can call like a ball or something for delay of game.
Yeah.
In baseball. And I actually think there's a lot of people though I know who are like, yeah, I like the NFL, but it's just so slow and it's this and that. And they're like, I actually like college more because it's such a fast-paced, high-scoring game.
Yeah, but the college games last 4.5 hours.
Because of that, though.
But here's the other thing. Like, the NBA has taken the replay system and made it all in New York. In other words, the officials aren't making any kind of decision. It's all being made in New York. Would that speed up the process, Pat? Another, you know,
I would love Park Avenue to be responsible for all these calls, and I don't, and I believe me, I'll meet Stephen Jones, Bob McNair, guys I talk to. Those guys want a central flow to move these games along. And these full-time official theories, I argue with Coach Carr about this a lot. I'll tell you who should be full-time. The guy in the booth. You should hire about 20 of the older guys that can't run anymore that are smart. And you know what? They trump the field official. But this goes all the way back to the guys who hated replay when it first came in, and they didn't want it to work. And they said, we don't want to take any power away from the guys on the field. The guy in the field is powerless because of technology. The guy upstairs set him up, and I know the networks had said they'd do it for him, set him up, and he sends down to the field, hey, stop the game, you blew the call, give him back the ball. Hey, good, touchdown, move on. They could trim these games down by 20 minutes, easy. Forget all the replays, every penalty on average is a two-minute experience. So when you have 20 penalties in a game, the first two games in London were 48 penalties. Are you kidding? We're trying to sell the game to the British and we're showing them 48 penalty worth. Come on. You know what? A cousin of mine who's from Ireland went over to the game all excited. You know what he said? Here's his conclusion. He goes, do the players know? Do they know the rules? Because they keep breaking them. I go, look.
It's unbelievable,
this,
right?
We're going to have 3.5 hour games every week.
But if they – okay, let's go to the Fells play. If that play happens and it goes right to New York to make a decision on it and they make the decision, period, bing, that's not a catch. It's over and done with, right? It's quick.
Yes.
It's done.
Catch.
So I think that's what – the NBA took it out of the hands of the officials. They make the calls, but they took it out of the hands of the officials. Here's one last night, though, that kind of perplexed me a little bit. Do you remember the intentional there should have been a safety in the end zone for intentional grounding. They said the ball came – to the line of scrimmage or near the line of scrimmage, and when they showed the replay, it was 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage.
Well, first off, this is going to be a call on Russell Wilson.
Well, shouldn't
Pat,
it have been reviewed?
As you know how he hates
no,
it.
No, shouldn't it have been reviewed?
There was actually a fullback, number 45, the big boy. He was actually out in the very far side of the screen. You could see him releasing out there. He was
within
5 yards.
But that's not
why
they made the call, because they said the ball came close or at near the line of scrimmage. Well, not because it was near a player.
Yeah, their explanation
that wasn't what I heard, but
exposed them. Because when you saw the replay, it wasn't anywhere close to what they said.
Couldn't that have been challenged by Arians?
He won two last night.
He should have challenged that one. You can challenge if the ball comes near or at the line of scrimmage, which is why they didn't call it a
– But did they end up getting a safety like the next play or whatever again? That was a different series?
Yeah.
Different series.
But Arians should – am I wrong, Pat? Arians should he should have challenged that.
Well, Brady should laugh at this too. Every team has a guy that knows the rules. Jim Skipper is the one that Ron Rivera uses and knows when to challenge and knows when he should take a time. He's that guy. That's one of the most important guys for a head coach. I know Ron listens to Jim all the time. But you wouldn't believe how many of these coaches get so wound up in a game, Rex Ryan, and they don't listen to their guy.
Well, the Giants made a blunder at one of their vintage time management blunders at the end of the game yesterday. Did you see that?
Yeah.
They had a first and goal at the 6 with the and had to use a timeout. Now, the ball went out of bounds, but they had to use a timeout because the play clock was running down. Then they threw twice and had the Beckham play, so essentially touchdown, so it's hard to fault him for it. And then on third down, he was rolling out, and he took a sack because he didn't want to go out of bounds, and he wanted the Patriots to use their timeout. But don't you run it a couple times there and make them use their timeouts?
You'd think so.
I would, number one. But Brady, I was going to ask Brady today that question if he saw the play. The we've exhausted the roll right pass for either 2 points or down where they had Eli do it.
I mean, dude,
he rolled away from Beckham.
Well, and here's the thing that I don't get is you could hear it clear as day. We talked about earlier today about the sound being so good. Q8. We've used Q8 sprint right option for years in the West Coast system. Ben McAdoo, call it something else, because even defenders can hear Q8 and everyone knows what the play call is. You immediately watch the New England Patriots secondary back off and sit there instead of just allowing, I think it was Harris who was going to kind of come in the option route underneath. They just stayed right where they were. It was ridiculous. And it's like at some point, the West Coast needs to change some of the terminology because it's been around way too long. But and then also that play, it's just not effective anymore. It really isn't. Like I'm such a big proponent now of a lot of these run pass options where you essentially call run play. You give your quarterback the opportunity to read those linebackers on the back end. If they bite up on the run, you pull it and you hit a slant or a post and in behind it. If they don't, you hand the football off. It's as simple as that. They do it all the time at the college level. Peyton used to do it a little bit once he got down there as well. In the red zone, and I'm surprised that more teams don't do it. I know Tom Brady and those guys do it more from under center than in gun, where it's not even necessarily an option quite as much. It's just a called run play where you're kind of pulling off of it and you're hitting someone in the back of the end zone. But it's just unbelievable to me how archaic we still use sprint right option.
I know. It's terrible. The Jameis Winston bootleg for the winning touchdown. I mean, there was no pass option. No one went out. Tell me what you do, Brady. If you pull, if you just run. You're Jameis. You try to get on the edge, and they're pulling you up. I mean, he's not racing anybody to the corner. What are you going to do there? Because you can't throw. You can't throw to air. Maybe you can if he's outside the pocket by then. But I love the call. It worked. But I'm wondering, he had no real options anywhere except getting hit.
Yeah, and I've been in that scenario before, where a lot of times they'll call, you know, that run play, and maybe they say to you, hey, or you'll talk about during the week, if you think you can get around the edge, don't tell anyone, just keep it, because so that way it'll sell this play that much more. Those are always the best quarterback keeps.
Yeah,
we were in 2009, we were with the Cleveland Browns playing the Chiefs, and literally had the exact same scenario towards the end of the game. The Chiefs had just come back, I think, to tie it up. It's a tied up at this point, so we're trying to drive down for a field goal. But we only had, like, I don't even know how much time left, maybe a minute, 2 minutes left in the game. And literally, he kind of buzzed my ear, hey, if you think you can keep it, keep it. And then just as I get under center, the weak safety walks down the edge of the line of scrimmage, and he's going, no, 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 and it clicks off at the 15-second mark for the coach, the quarterback. And sure enough, I ended up running a fake, keep it, ran for about 30 yards up the sidelines, ended up getting a Liz Frank injury on that play. We end up running the football in at that point to score and go ahead and win the game. But literally, I still like laugh about it to this day because there was no other option. Had that safety not bitten on the run fake, I was screwed.
Yeah, and if you watch that Jameis play, it looked great, but I'm asking myself, what the heck was going to happen if this happened? It was -5 is what it was going to be.
Before we get out of here and wrap up, Ben Roethlisberger was not supposed to play on Sunday. He was the backup quarterback who was healthy and was number two quarterback. So when I first saw that, I'm thinking, well, if he's number two, why wouldn't you just play him? Right? And then he went in when Landry Jones got hurt, and he played, really well. What does that say? Something doesn't jive there. It's either he wasn't that hurt and they felt they could win with Landry Jones against the bad. They're almost saying the Browns stink, right? Isn't that what it sounded like, Brady?
You're directing this to me?
Yeah, I want to hear it for you.
I'm more curious to hear what Pat thinks about it, but I essentially, when I saw him come in and then tear them up like he did, I was drawn to the same conclusion. I was almost curious to see if they would have played Roethlisberger had McCown started, and maybe they thought like McCown would make the Browns a bit more competitive than Johnny did, even though Johnny played better. Still struggles to really throw effectively from the pocket. I think he had 6 sacks and
he threw for 380 something yards.
Yeah, so. But they were down so early. Yard. He had to. Yeah,
but he was better.
He was better.
He should play.
There's no doubt he should probably play, but it's also there's a lot of other guys in the locker room, Pete, who you can't say, well, we want to see what this guy is capable of, instead of trying to win games and trying to allow guys to have.
Oh, sure you can. You're the coach.
But Counts played well, though, so it's not fair Patton's to say it to him.
I think Patton's the problem.
Well, Pat, I'm either way, I'm curious to see idea of what was going on.
I was sitting with Bill Cowher when all this was going on, and so the first thing is we tried to find out at 10:30 in the morning is Ben going to play? Is Ben going to be active? That was the first pursuit I was under, and Bill was making his calls. And I promise you, at 9:30 in the morning, they were not sure he was going to be active. They were waiting for Ben to say that if he could go or not, and that he had left it in a kind of a gray area on Saturday. So they weren't even sure they were going to have him. That was the first step. Then I think when they knew Manziel was starting, I do believe they felt like, well, let's try to get the guy an extra week's rest. And if Landry Jones is losing at halftime and he's stinking up the place, then we'll have to play Ben. So if that's an indictment of what they think of the Browns, well, that the Browns are entitled to see it that way. I think they were trying to get through it, and obviously they couldn't. But I know this, when a guy says, I think I can go, you have to say to him, which I know was said to him, if he goes down early, you're going to have to play the whole game. That's what we're asking you. Can you do that? I don't know what the alternative was. I think Vic is still hurt, isn't he?
Yeah.
Was their alternative?
They've got the wide receiver, the kid from, he was a Boston College, more athletic quarterback.
Yeah.
He comes in.
That's the alternative.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because to me, not to extend this too long, it brings along the idea of, what percentage, you look at Peyton Manning, right? He tried to tough it out, tried to play this week. Kubiak has since said that he's battling with a lot of injuries and they're trying to figure out how they're going to handle it. But at what point is Peyton Manning's 80% or 85% or Ben Roethlisberger's 80 or 85%, at what point is that, good enough to still make, still keep them in, still have them play? Because it looks like at Peyton Manning, his 80 or 75%, whatever he is right now at 39, isn't obviously good enough to be effective in a game, whereas Ben Roethlisberger at his age, at this point in time in his career, his 80% seems to be easily good enough to still win games in the NFL.
And when does it get to a point where a guy is too stubborn for his own good? In other words, everybody wants to play. I mean, for the most part, most players want to play. They'll play through stuff. But when does it become, okay, now you got to be smart, like Pat said earlier, and just step back for a couple weeks. And whose decision is that? Is that Peyton's decision? Is that Roethlisberger's decision if he's in it? Who makes that decision?
Because the head coach has to make it. Because the player, first off, and Brady knows, these guys have great love of the game. They have great respect for their teammates. They might have egocentric goals they're trying to meet as well. But at the end of the day, it's hard to walk into your locker room and the players in there think, you know what, you could play. And you just take an extra week of precaution. That is a bad place to put yourself in. I don't think guys like Manning ever put themselves in that place. So besides records and everything else he wants to break and all that nonsense, I think the truth is he does. He made a comment, which I think is true. He goes, hey, Tlaib was out. DeMarcus was out. I just kind of felt I better go. I believe him.
Yeah, I do too, and I think it all obviously speaks to, his competitiveness and his courage to want to fight through it and do that. I think Pete, you touched on it. Every player has that in them where they don't want to be Wally Pipp. They don't want to be the guy that allows someone come up from behind them and steal their job. That's how competitive it is at any professional level, especially in sports. But I think in his case too. I mean, look, you talked about the injury, Pat. You just talked about the injuries that they had. I mean, this is a team who kind of realizes that they've been pretty inconsistent this season. I mean, they need everyone playing at their best, I think, in order to get wins at time, at least how this season's looked so far.
Before we get out of here, one last thing, and this is kind of sums up this season for us. 3 weeks ago, they had the mega game in Denver, undefeated, 6-0, first meeting, Packers and Broncos. Here we are 3 weeks later. One team has three losses, the other team has two, and is trying to figure out who's going to play quarterback for them going forward. This thing can change in a hurry.
It absolutely does change in a hurry, and we see teams closing in on a lot of these. At least three divisional races have tightened down to you can't call it. I said it last week. I'll say it now. at the end of week 9 last year, five of the division winners were not in first place. The five teams that won their divisions were not in first place. So we can look at all these divisions next week and see who's creeping up from second and third place and getting ready to take over first.
All right, we will do that next week on our Monday edition of Roughing the Passer.